From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
San Pablo.
I live in Novato.
Emeryville.
Rockridge.
I live in Berkeley.
Coming up, we find a collection of curious items in an unexpected place.
This is a zip gun that was used in an escape in the 1960s. And this is a piece of toilet paper, has a piece cut out to hide some narcotics.
Visiting the San Quentin Prison Museum. Then we'll check out an exhibit on Alcatraz that reveals the price kids pay when their parents are sent to prison.
It was hard growing up without him there. Like, I had to learn how to shave on my own. I had to learn how to do things, you know, all by myself, which, you know, sometimes led to me going down the wrong path.
And we'll hear what it takes to write a comic memoir about going to Berkeley High School.
This is happening to me right now, and it's the most intense thing that anyone ever felt in their lives, and I need to tell everyone about it.
Tribulations, trials, and teenagehood. Today on Cross Currents. Just off the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge in Marin County, there's a campus of beige buildings with sparkling bay water lapping at its shore. This is San Quentin Prison, home to about 3,600 inmates today. If you're a regular listener to our show, you've probably heard the San Quentin Prison Report.
The San Quentin Prison Report.
Bringing you hidden stories from life inside.
We're not going to hear from a current inmate today, because we've got something different. See, there's a museum on site that has the story of all of San Quentin's yesterdays. KALW's Chris Hambrick has the story.
They had me at homemade shiv wall. Shiv is a slang term for an improvised weapon. I heard the San Quentin Prison Museum has enough shivs to make an entire display, and I want to see them all.
You know where the library is?
Library?
I'm sorry.
Is it that one that says museum?
Yes.
Okay.
I go through a checkpoint and sign in, but it's easy to forget that I'm on a prison campus because there are manicured trees and fluffy bushes. The guard at the gate smiles and jokes as he asks for my ID and points me in the right direction. The museum building itself is a Tudor-style house done in olive drab stucco. A sign hanging from the awning reads simply, Museum Open. This is where I meet my two tour guides for the day.
My name is Jeff Kramer. I'm the curator of the San Quentin Museum.
I'm Lieutenant Sam Robinson. I'm the public information officer at San Quentin State Prison.
Robinson points at the photos of all the past wardens lining the wall and asks me to guess which guy died at his desk. It's like a macabre game of Where's Waldo?
Look around at these photos and see if you can pick out who that individual is.
Okay. All right. So it's not the guy who's standing.
Off the tile floor lobby, there's a huge display. It's a timeline of the prison from 1852 up until the 1980s. There are photos, drawings, and lots of text. Words are fine, but the best way to view this prison's history is by looking at the objects here. Want to learn about the death penalty and the gas chamber? Robinson has you covered.
Let's see, I think we have a mock of it.
He shows me a bright green metal scale model. It's an octagon with a door, windows, and a pointed roof. There are two seats inside.
The first execution here at this facility was actually a double execution. Two people who murdered the warden at Folsom State Prison back in 1937 were the first two people to be executed here 1 year later in 1938. And so the facility was designed to accommodate two, and over the course of its history, 22 times we've utilized it for multiple people at once.
Kramer shows me the item he says draws the most curious stares from visitors.
This was the noose that hung of Rattlesnake James, man that killed six wives with a rattlesnake. And I got this noose from the hangman's daughter.
That same hangman's daughter also gave the museum a wooden cigar box filled with tiny nooses. Her father made one for each person he executed and tagged it with the prisoner's number. And there are more scale models.
That's what the gallows looked like here in the prison, and then it was torn down to replace by the gas chamber.
There is no shortage of dark humor in this place. Kramer and I look at the hanging record for Rattlesnake James.
This is a description of him. His height, his weight, his drop, and how long it took him to die.
You have to read that for
me. It says very successful.
We leave the sterile death wing and go up three steps to a large carpeted room filled with lit display cases. In those cases are straitjackets, guns, and an actual ball and chain. Kramer's got a story for every object. He points out an item made by an inmate in the 1950s.
That little steam engine in the bottom was made by a man, William Wells. He was a nice man in San Rafael, and he made things. But he got fingered with something of like an assault on a child or something like that. And he was so taken by it and shocked, he couldn't speak. Poor Willie, all he could do was bark. So he got the name of Barking Willie. And so he wandered around here, and he made this little steam engine. It actually works.
My eyes get wide looking inside the contraband case.
Is that a shovel? Number nine.
Yep.
Let's see. It's homemade shovel for tunneling.
Yep. And this is a zip gun that was used in an escape in the 1960s. And this is a piece of toilet paper. It has a piece cut out to hide some narcotics or something like that in there. And then the shaft the toilet paper spindles on is a stabbing weapon. Kind of use everything you can.
Wow. Oh, that, okay, that thing underneath that looks like an ice pick was inside.
Yeah, it's a...
Wow.
Speaking of stabbing, I spy what really drew me to this museum.
Is that the shiv wall? The homemade shiv wall?
Robinson has the story for this one.
That's exactly what this is. Actually, this weapon here kind of mirrors a weapon that was utilized to murder the last employee here at San Quentin. The inmate was actually inside of his cell, and what he did is he got some newspaper, he rolled it up, let it dry out, and when it dries like a broomstick or a handle. And what he did is he tied a little weapon onto the end of that, that handle, so to say. And from inside of his cell, as the employee walked by, someone called the employee's name out, the employee turned, and as he was positioned just right, he thrust it out through the cell bars and stabbed him in his heart. Yeah.
So it means you guys really have to stay on top of everything.
It's just kind of some of the things that in society you don't think about, you don't even have to worry about, but in prison, everything we have to be accountable for.
Murder aside, these shivs are a showcase of ingenuity. There are sharpened screwdrivers, nails hidden inside of pen cases, filed down paint rollers, just loads of pointy things that someone put a handle on. But the museum isn't all about weapons. There's stuff about the short-lived women's wing, a display of military supplies the prisoners made during World War II, and photos showing some of the inmates' recreational activities. To get a sense of what it's like to live here, I step inside the model cell at the museum. It's the same size of the ones inside the prison.
So the cell is long and narrow. There's a toilet at the back, and I'm gonna stretch my arms out to see if I can touch both sides of the wall at the same time. Yeah, and my elbows are bent, so that's about the width of the cell.
It's easy to imagine how being confined to such a small space would make you dream of busting out.
This is a wall of escapes, and in the early days, people would braid bed sheets together. And there's a grappling hook that was made over the wall and climb over and go. And there was one escape where...
Kramer has a twinkle in his eyes as he tells the adventure of a posse car chase and eventual capture of the escapees. It's like he's reliving memories. In a way, he is. He grew up nearby and remembers what a company town this area was when he was a boy. He's a storehouse of fascinating tales, and he'll share them with you if you visit. Just be glad this is one trip to prison where you get to come and go voluntarily. For Cross Currents, I'm Chris Hambrick.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney. When someone is imprisoned, it doesn't just affect the incarcerated. It affects the people left behind, young people. Nearly 3 million children in the United States have parents in the criminal justice system. It's almost 1 in 10 kids in California alone. It can be costly and difficult to visit or call a parent behind bars, and losing a relationship can be traumatic with lasting consequences. A new art exhibit on Alcatraz Island called The Sentence Unseen examines this reality. KALW's Catherine Girardot has the story.
Inside the crumbling walls of Alcatraz, 16-year-old Arvon Williams shows me a big, glossy photograph of himself, standing in a garden, smiling and confident, with a plaid scarf stylishly tied at his neck. Under the photo, there's a quote posted, which he reads to me.
My most vivid childhood memory are those from the first few years I had with my father. We'd go fishing and he'd take me on go-kart rides and to amusement parks. But his incarceration changed that. Because of his incarceration, I became resilient. I have to show the world that I won't fall into this system and this cycle that traps so many people, like black men like myself.
Williams is a junior at City Arts and Technology High School in San Francisco and a youth advocate with Project What, a program that raises awareness about what it means to live with a parent in prison. The What in Project What stands for We're Here and Talking. He says he had only intermittent contact with his dad after the age of 5. But there was one very important conversation 3 years ago, shortly before his dad passed away.
I had told him that it was hard growing up without him there. Like, I had to learn how to shave on my own. I had to learn how to do things, you know, all by myself. So, you know, I had to really grow up and find some things out for my own, which, you know, sometimes led to me going down the wrong path. And I told him that he could have curbed all of that if his presence was just within the household.
Although the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation doesn't track the number of inmates who are parents, studies estimate that nearly 1 in 10 California children have a parent in the criminal justice system. Public health studies show that, for kids, having an incarcerated parent is associated with a high level of childhood trauma. So Project What put together a set of policy recommendations for the County of San Francisco that aims to make things just a little easier for kids with parents behind bars. Family visits can help alleviate some of the stress, but those visits can be infrequent and hard to organize. Prisoners are often housed far from home, and some families can't afford the travel costs to visit their loved ones.
I visited him like 2 weeks ago for the first time in like 3 years because my family doesn't have all the money to be going there every 2 weeks or even once a month.
16-year-old Oakland resident Sitali Lupian's dad was incarcerated when she was just 8 months old. In the years since, he's been transferred at least 5 times. Standing in front of her portrait, the soft-spoken young woman with brilliant maroon hair tells me about her dad's most recent move.
He was in Folsom, which is like an hour or two away. And then no one told me that he got transferred. I didn't know until he sent a letter, and the stamp said Pelican Bay State Prison, and I was like, where is that?
It was in Crescent City, more than 350 miles north of the Bay Area. One of Project What's policy recommendations is for the city of San Francisco to provide travel funding to families to cover the child's transportation costs for a minimum of 6 visits per year. While there are some limited free bus services to some prisons, families generally have to figure it out on their own, carpooling and sharing expenses. And when they get there, the visit may not go as planned.
Because he's in solitary confinement, I had to see him behind the glass, through the window, and like with the phone, and it was only 3 hours.
Lupian says she wasn't able to hug, touch, or even hear her dad very well. But what she did hear meant a lot to her.
I remember I almost started crying because he told me that he really loved me and like he had never loved anybody as much as he loved me. Yeah, and then he started talking to my mom and she started saying how like, oh, she's such an amazing daughter and all that. And like, well, I think all three of us started crying.
Lupion's father has been present for some important moments in her life. She took her first steps during a visit to Corcoran State Prison when she was a year old. But that's luck. Incarcerated parents usually aren't there to witness their kids' milestones. Project What alumnus and youth advocate Tony Shavers says that's part of what they're trying to change.
We go up to Sacramento, we lobby in front of state legislators, policy directors, to really get them thinking about what policies and what changes need to go into effect to really help children.
The help they're advocating for extends to when parents are released, because there are some parts of incarceration that are harder for policy to address, like feelings of disappointment, abandonment, and loss. Joe Calderon was released from prison 4 years ago. He's here today with his family, including his daughter Jessica, a youth advocate with Project What.
Jessica was born while I was in county jail. I got put C in holder one time before I went to prison. I did write as often as I could, and I made sure that I sent her drawings, sent her birthday cards since she was, you know, one and up, explaining, you know, who I was and how much I cared about her and how important she was to me.
When Calderon came home after 17 years in prison, it was the first time he'd lived in the same household as his daughter, Jessica.
When he was incarcerated, I feel like we had a good relationship, but that's basing it off of, like, visiting him maybe every other month and almost kind of being, like, distant relatives.
Now that her dad is home, Jessica says their relationship is sometimes tough.
There's things I'm not used to. He's very old school, and that's the way he was raised, and I wasn't so much raised that way, so obviously there's, like, still some, like, sort of prison mentality sometimes, I'm sure, to that.
Joe Calderon says he's turned his life around. He works for the Transitions Clinic on the San Francisco Reentry Council, helping former inmates integrate back into life on the outside. And, he says,
I made the decision to put my family first.
His daughter Jessica tries to stay focused on the present rather than the past, but sometimes it's hard.
I would be lying if I said I'm not still resentful a little bit, sometimes even still, but overall I was happy, or at least hopeful, to have my father back and hope that we could rebuild that bond.
She says it would help to feel like she didn't have to do that work on her own.
I think it's very important that children, before their parents come back, there's that counseling and that there's that talk about what the family dynamic will look like, and also when they come back, well, what's working, what's not working, how can we make it work?
Providing family support services is just one of the policies Project What hopes to have passed. Four of their recommendations have already been approved by the San Francisco Police Commission and the San Francisco Sheriff. The group hopes to get the next six passed as well. For Cross Currents, on Alcatraz Island, I'm Catherine Girardeau.
You can see The Sentence Unseen, Portraits of Resilience, on Alcatraz through August 31st, or catch the exhibit at Oakland's African American Museum and Library beginning in October. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney. While growing up with your parent in prison is an especially difficult challenge, every teenager has a unique experience of making her way through high school. The Berkeley-born writer Ariel Schrag first gained success by writing a series of four autobiographical coming-of-age graphic novels, one about each year she spent at Berkeley High School. The first two were published before she graduated. Schrag's made a career as a writer. She's written for television, including for the Showtime series The L Word. She recently finished her first novel, Adam, and is currently living in Brooklyn. Ariel Schrag joined KALW's Jeremy Dalmas to talk about her work, which is often set in the Bay Area.
So you came out with your first novel, Adam, last year. Can you just describe, like, a summary of the book?
Sure. It's basically about a straight teenage boy living in Piedmont, kind of very sheltered life, who is kind of a loser, gets kicked out of his friend group at school, and goes and spends the summer with his older lesbian sister, Casey, who's just finished her freshman year at Columbia, and kind of joins her gang of queer friends, for lack of anything else to do, kind of tags along with her to all these parties, and winds up then being mistaken for a trans man, because there are a lot of trans men in Casey's queer scene, and ends up allowing this girl he has a crush on to believe he is trans.
I think a lot of people, at least that I talk to, their first question is, why did you choose Adam as the main character for the story?
Yeah, a lot of people ask me that, and I actually find it such a weird question because that is the story. Like, the story is this cis teenage boy passes as a trans man, but at the same time, it makes sense. It's a question that makes sense because the book is really me commenting on and writing about this subculture that I was a part of. And if I were to be aligned with a character, I am sort of superficially more aligned with Casey. I went to Columbia. I was part of this scene. I was a 19-year-old lesbian living in this world. So, but her story was not interesting to me. I was sort of interested in the dynamics of this culture and thought it would be really intriguing to sort of approach it through the eyes of this teenage boy in this bizarre predicament of sort of deception.
I think Adam does a lot of things that I would say are maybe immoral. I don't know.
I think you can say that. Yeah.
Okay, good. I at least that's what I thought.
Definitely wrong.
Definitely wrong. But at the same time, he's just a kid, and I think he's portrayed really quite sympathetically in the book. I mean, mm-hmm. you hear it from his perspective. Yeah. How would you feel about Adam if you met him?
Well, it's funny. I did a reading once, and this kid came up to me afterwards, and he was like, I have to tell you something. It's like, this kind of creepy teenager. I did that. I pretended to be trans. And I was kind of like, holy shit. I was shocked. Apparently he kept his deception to the internet. He didn't go out in real life. But I was definitely like, ugh, you are a creep. I mean, it's a creepy thing. Like, I think that I definitely was more interested in telling the story where you were able to empathize with Adam. I mean, that's the challenge. You know, you can write any story and be like, ew, a creepy guy did a creepy thing. Him, that's kind of the end of it. The thing that made it interesting was to sort of be like, what is the scenario that would get somebody to do this, and what would it mean to sort of empathize with that?
I mean, that's what makes the book so interesting. So you started writing comic memoirs when you were 15?
Yeah, well, I started Awkward about my freshman year at Berkeley High when I was 15.
You went to Berkeley High School, mm-hmm. and you ended up writing a graphic novel about each year of high school. So I wanted to ask, why write a comic memoir while you are still so young?
If I sort of think back to the first inspiration, I had been experimenting with comics and autobiographical comics for a while. I was really obsessed with the strip For Better or For Worse. And I had this kind of strip called Live It Like Me that was sort of like about a girl in eighth grade. And then my freshman year, I sort of discovered zines and alternative comics, particularly this comic called Deep Girl by a cartoonist, Ariel Bordeaux, that she self-published. And I just felt really inspired to write about everything that had happened to me in my ninth grade year of high school, which had been Berkeley High, and sort of, you know, did drugs for the first time, got drunk for the first time, like did sexual things for the first time. Like, just all these firsts were so exciting to me that I just really wanted to share with people what had happened. And then when Awkward, you know, seemed to be received well and people wanted to buy it, I just was like, I'm going to keep doing this. Oh.
So we went to high school together.
Yes.
I'm 2 years younger than you. Yes. And when I was in high school, I thought you were really, really cool. And I bought your comic from your sister, who's my age. And I have to say, I think it was pretty influential on me in terms of the fact that I did music in high school.
Cool.
And I put out 4 albums in high school, like sort of DIY, you know, do-it-yourself music stuff. And I think that, like, seeing you work on such an ambitious project made me want to do
That's so cool. It's really, really awesome. I love
so
that.
I guess, number one, thank you for that. Aww. And I guess what was maybe your influence on, you know, starting, you know, something so big of a project?
Yeah. Well, definitely that comic I discovered, Deep Girl, had a big effect on me. Something about finding this self-published zine on the consignment rack at Comic Relief was like, oh, I can do that. Like, I can make something like this.
A lot of those 4 graphic novels were quite graphic and very intimate.
Yes.
And I'm curious, like, at at 35, how it feels to have your adolescence just like on the page for everyone to see. Maybe even like people you meet for the first time have like already read about it.
I mean, it does really kind of shock me, honestly. Like, I look at it, I don't regret it, and I certainly remember being in the mindset of writing that, but I am also kind of like, whoa. I think when you get older, there's a certain self-consciousness of, oh, my feelings aren't that original, or they're not that important, or they're other people have it worse, or whatever. And a teenager is not really concerning themselves with that. They're like, this is happening to me right now, and it's the most intense thing that anyone ever felt in their lives, and I need to tell everyone about it.
I mean, I think that's what makes it so powerful and work so well, is that there's like, there isn't that filter there.
Yeah, I guess like my advice if you wanted to write something similar would be that you just have to do it when you're a teenager.
That was writer and cartoonist Ariel Schrag talking with KALW's Jeremy Dalmas. Do you have a coming-of-age story? Call us at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. And tell us about it. Because of you, we can proudly say we are listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Hannah Baba, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Angela Johnston, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, Emma Nobel, Seth Samuel, Lizak Shalit, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Line producer is Jeremy Dalmas. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our managing producer is Julie Kane. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.